Albert Newnham kept his ear to the door. It was as if he could hear minutely the shadows of the trees brushing its surface. Just a door between him and the great dark wilderness outside, and too distant to be sure, the hollow tap of fighting sticks jostling each other, even though he knew it was just the wind in the upper branches of the thorn trees. Though the war was over, the rebels arrested and sent to break stones for the harbour wall in the Cape, or to the island where once the Xhosa chiefs had been incarcerated, little had changed. He had been told that gangs still roved the country, and there was a sullenness about the people at the mission. Conversations between his men he could not follow, but which were silenced at his approach. At night he closed the shutters and locked the doors. He never sat on the veranda in the evening smoking his pipe and looking at the stars, as he had when he first came to St. Paul's. Now, on each journey to an outstation, he was aware of every shadow, every flick of his horse's ears. He often listened at the door, as he had the year before, armed with an old carbine that he had no idea how to load and fire. But that night, as he stood alert, all he could hear was the sound of Unity sobbing in the bedroom. Again. Though she had repeatedly resolved to be a courageous, resilient Englishwoman, she had buckled very quickly after her return to St. Paul's, despite her determination to support dearest, dearest Bertie, marooned there among the barbarous heathen hordes. He knew she was overwhelmed with irrational fears. If she had rallied bravely at their first posting to St. Paul's, before the war, knowing it would end when Jackson appeared at last, the spectre of that unhappy missionary now seemed to haunt her. Seemingly at the brink of disintegration herself, she constantly used the drama of Reverend Jackson's descent into madness as a foil to her own despair. "Unity, I will not discuss Mr. Jackson any more," Albert had exploded at last. "Perhaps it was his wife who drove him to insanity." But it was not the Reverend Mr. Jackson who had preoccupied Unity of late. It was something much more urgent. A conversation she simply dared not broach with Albert. A letter that had come with a messenger while Albert had been at an outstation. A letter she had opened even though it was not addressed to her. It was from Stephen Mzamane, announcing that he was coming to the mission to consult. He did not divulge about what. The more Unity read the letter, the more alarmed she became, the victim of an imagination teetering at the edge of hysteria. After all, it was Stephen's brother who had been arrested near their mission, armed, red-cloaked, a Christian turned savage. And when he had been brought to the jail in Grahamstown, Albert could offer no satisfactory explanation for the jacket the prisoner had worn. A jacket that belonged to Albert. When she had pressed him, he had made a feeble excuse about leaving it in Queenstown, and then became quite unlike himself when she pounced on the fact that money, in an envelope addressed to him, had been found in the pocket. Belligerent. Bertie, belligerent? She concluded that he was too proud to admit that he had been wrong about the natives, and about Stephen in particular. Since then, she had rifled through his correspondence and found the letter in which Stephen had confessed to not reporting the death of a boy to the police. Concealing a murder? "I have reported the matter to God." As if that exonerated him, and now he had written again, announcing his arrival, playing on Bertie's sympathy, wanting his counsel, eager to consult, and not saying why.